They worked the fields at Placid Hall during the day, keeping their heads down and avoiding trouble, but the nights became theirs. For love, for friendship, sometimes celebration, all under the stars and behind the backs of those who had enslaved them. In his new book called Yonder, Jabari Yassim tells the stories of six men and women, five of them enslaved, and the plantation owners who stole them, in the words of the book. It is a brutal telling of struggle, love, toil, and freedom. In just a few moments, author Jabari Yassim, who is also a professor of writing at Emerson College, will join us to talk about the book, Yonder. He's been a regular guest of ours in the past, talking about a range of issues, including a terrific conversation 2 years ago on Black fatherhood. We've looked forward to an opportunity to have him back, and he joins us now. Jabari, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Jabari, I'm going to actually start by asking you to read a passage right at the beginning of the book, Yonder, please. And before you start, I want to say this to listeners. Listeners, heads up. We have left the passage as it is from the book on purpose, and that passage contains language that many will find offensive. So heads up if you're listening. Jabari, will you go ahead and read us that passage, please?
Sure. Again and again, words fail to save us. Still, as unsteady as they seemed, they were often all we had. Without words of our own, we'd have no choice but to see the world as they saw it. And even though we witnessed life unfold through very different eyes, we shared with our captors a need to believe that names could affect the turn of events. We called them thieves. They called themselves God's children. We called ourselves stolen. They called us niggas. Our language, our secret tongue, was our last defense.
That is author Jabari Yassim reading from his book, Yonder. Jabari, there are so many times in this story, and we'll give a synopsis in a minute, but I do want to start here on language, where my bones shook by the decisions that you made. And one was, I can tell you're pleased by that. And one was this choice to frame this as thieves and the stolen. Let's start right with that detail.
Sure. I mean, I'm always intrigued by different versions of an event as told by more than one person, right? So I think that much of our racial tension stems from a clash of stories. One group of people saying it happened this way, another group of people saying it happened that way. So I wanted to cast the story from the very beginning as competing versions of the same events.
And let's talk about that. You tell the story from many perspectives. We have chapters from William's perspective, Margaret, Cato, Pandora, they are enslaved. We hear from Ransom, who is an itinerant preacher. We also have several other characters, including a compelling young person named Little Xander, who doesn't have his own chapters but figures in. Why unwind the story from these alternating perspectives, beginning with their experience on the plantation and ending with an attempt to journey to freedom?
Well, you know, initially, I have to say, I didn't intend to do that. I envisioned it as William's story. And as I began to write the story, the voices of other characters became more insistent. And I realized that it might work if I told the story through multiple lenses, as it were. So I began to experiment with it that way. I had William talk about some things that happened. Then I had Cato talk about those same things. And I looked to see how it might be different and whether or not it would work as a story. And the number of narrators just kind of expanded from there.
In our contested and painful history, Jabari, and I recognize this is fiction, but you've said in some previous interviews that sometimes we can do more with fiction than we can with nonfiction. In our contested pieces of history, is it really important to tell it from multiple perspectives, to underscore how contested our versions are?
I think it's really helpful. I mean, I'm even interested in the versions of the story that are directly oppositional to me and my culture. And I think I can learn some things from that. I think language reveals so much about how we see the world and how we interact with other people that it just makes sense to pay close attention to it, both as a writer and a reader and as a listener.
So tell us about William. You know, most of our listeners will not have read this book. He is, to me, as a reader, the heartbeat of the story, even though he's not the only perspective. And he's the story we start with. And he is shaped by early trauma and tragedy and a pragmatic man who just wants to get through day to day.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've nailed him. A lot of the characters want to engage in philosophical speculation about the nature of God, the nature of the universe, the nature of freedom. And William is always the character who says, I keep both my feet on the ground. I'm not going to be thinking too much about those things. It's really about the day-to-day struggle for me. And another character says about him, you know, he's very brave, but he isn't necessarily the smartest of the characters, right? So there is some value in his bravery and in his strength, but he really has to rely on his colleagues who will say to him, wait, hold up, let's think about this first.
And the women, Margaret, Pandora, who are in love with William and Cato, are powerful women. They are strong women. And there were several times where I found myself thinking, was it hard for you to write them? Did you worry that you'd do them justice as a man writing these women?
Well, I think I worried whether I would do them justice, you know, as a writer creating these characters. My preoccupations there weren't gender-oriented because, you know, I've been exposed, obviously, to women and specifically to African-American women. And I think I have some understanding, at the very least, of their voices and personalities, et cetera. And based on those real-life experiences, I could use those as a springboard for my imagination and begin to conjure the rest out of the recesses of my brain. And, of course, it's always a gamble. You just don't know how it's going to land on the page, how it's going to land in readers' ears. And that's part of the risk we take.
So this community of men and women are enslaved at Placid Hall. We meet them there. We follow violence, torture, trauma, and resilience and love while they're there. And this itinerant preacher, Ransom, eventually convinces them to go to freedom. We're going to wind up with some spoilers here. So, listeners, we're going to wind up some spoilers here. But that is a tough journey. And the book switches almost to this surreal, the Iliad or the Odyssey kind of feel as they leave the horrible but predictable, you know, horribly predictable place they are and
right.
Try to journey to freedom. And I wonder, that sense of unrealness, why?
I think that's kind of where the story took me, and I think much of African American culture, at least the parts of it from which I spring, there is this idea that the border, quote unquote, between reality and the spiritual realm is very permeable. That there's interaction between these two places, as it were. And so I did want the action in the novel to reflect that, and I also at the same time I did want it to have an epic feel, which you've identified, because I think of the struggle of African Americans from bondage to freedom is very much an epic struggle. And I respond just very well as a reader and as a human being to attempts to cast it that way. And I want to encourage readers to look at it in the same way.
At the start of the book, before the book starts, so Roman numeral pages, right, before we're even in, we're just past the table of contents,
yes.
You start the book with a discussion of two tongues. And I'm going to read just a tiny bit of it. You were to sort of prologue. It reads in part, all of us have two tongues. The first is for them. And you explain that. And then you go on and say, the second is for us. It is a song of dreams and drums, whispered promises and incantations. It is, I wanted to ask you, I read that and I thought, I've talked to him. I've talked to him before. Have I been talking to somebody who's lived his whole life in a story of two tongues?
Well, to a certain extent, absolutely. I mean, nowadays people call it code switching, right? So, you know, my view is that these early enslaved Africans were among the earliest code switchers. They had no choice to be able to manipulate language on two different levels. It was a matter of life and death. And so there is some value in being able to speak to one's own community in a way that outsiders to that community are not privy to. But of course, there's considerable value that once you leave that community, that you be able to navigate and negotiate your way through this other landscape. And that is done most often through language. So yes, a short answer to your question is yes, I code switch. I have no choice. At the same time, as a writer, I revel in all of the possibilities that code switching presents.
Say more about that.
It's like if you were a composer and you had all these notes at your disposal, right? And so as a writer, I've got all this language. I've got idiomatic language. I've got textbook language. I've got language I pick up on the subway. I've got language I pick up in environments where I'm the only person who looks like me, right? I hear that language, and it sticks to me, too, like, you know, iron filings to a magnet. And then I return to my desk, and I look at all that, and I mix it all up, and I say, what can I do with this that will help me, you know, identify the right ingredients to create a compelling story? So, you know, it's a struggle, but it's very much a joyful one.
So I apologize if this seems like a silly question, but in listening to you just there, have you discovered new language? You know, not new words, but in some way a new language through that process and through the process of writing this book with so many voices telling their own versions here.
Well, I think it might make more sense to say that I have stumbled upon new rituals of language, which is, you know, one of the really important things in the book. I tried to imagine an alternative spiritual system that was language-based. So a lot of what happens in the character, all of the stolen people have seven words that were whispered in their ears when they were born. It's part of the ritual of the stolen experience. And they use those seven words. Each person has their own seven words, which they say in the morning, which they recite to themselves at night. And in moments of crisis, are a great challenge. So they function almost as prayer. And I think that's one of the ways that I didn't necessarily discover a new language, but I guess new ways that language could be employed in the service of the African-American struggle.
When I started the book, you know, I talked about the bone jarring. The two tongues was bone jarring. The stolen and the thieves were bone jarring. And to give away just a little bit of the book, the opening story of William witnessing dead bodies of babies and then a young child being considered unviable and murdered before his eyes. I realized you were not going to let me read your story without all the cruelty that tells it. And I wonder, go.
No, I was just going to say, I thought it was important to, once the characters are seriously considering whether they could take a risk on freedom, I thought it was important that readers have a full appreciation of what exactly it was they were trying to escape from.
Was that hard to write? I mean, there's torture and brutality and murder and callousness. And I also get it. There's a whole genre of fiction literature trying to begin to tell the story of the enslaved experience. This is a part of a canon that does that. But was it hard for you?
It wasn't particularly challenging in that regard because I read so much nonfiction as preparation for writing the story. Very few of the incidents of violence depicted in the book don't have, you know, some root in an actual incident that happened. And so that was helpful to me in that regard. At the same time, you know, I was aware of comments a few years back by a media personality who said, look, the slaves were well fed. You know, it's not the experience that, you know, black people are trying to convince you that it was. And so I knew that there was that kind of sentiment in the air as well. And I wanted to do all I could to challenge that and dispute it.
Is that why you wrote the book? I know that's reductionist, but you know, there is a choice one makes about the literature one writes.
Yeah. Well, it's less I wanted to fill in gaps in my own personal narrative. Like, I can trace my family history back, my relatives and I, to one particular couple, both of whom were born in captivity. But there was always this question, what about their parents? What about the couples before them? How did they come to be? And while I can't locate the precise historical record for that, I can't imagine it. And so the story began to emerge from those kinds of questions.
Cato and Pandora, Margaret and William, are couples that make it, literally and figuratively, in the book. I was surprised because so much of the book is stories of, if you dare be happy, if you dare be in love, you will be destroyed.
Yes, and one of the characters, Cupid, actually says that. You know, he says, love will ruin a stolen person, basically. So it's not in your best interest to fall in love. But, you know, we know it happened, and it happened often. And in William's case, almost against his will. You know, the last thing he wants to do is commit to a single person and make a family with that person. He thinks that's just an invitation to disaster, right? So that's part of the tension as well. Not only have I been fortunate enough to find someone who loves me, whom I love, but I'm also in the situation where that could change tomorrow. So there's always an urgency to their interactions.
What do you hope people take away from the book, Jabari? Or is that not how you think about it?
It's not how I think about it. I tend to think that way when I'm writing nonfiction. But with fiction, ultimately, I want them to just get lost in the story and to care about the characters. And that's what I hope will happen with people who take a chance on this book.
Well, I did. And I want to thank you for it. Jabari Yassin, professor of writing at Emerson College, author of the new book, Yonder. Jabari, always a pleasure to have you on Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us today.
I really appreciate it. Take care.